the corner of Route 45 South and Curtis Road in Savoy. Pages for All Ages offers a wide selection of books, compact discs, stationery, magazines, DVDs, children's books, and gift ideas, and features a full line of coffee, drinks, and teas at Pages Cafe. On the web at www.pagesforallages.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Academy for Entrepreneurial Leadership, offering the Entrepreneurial Faculty Fellows Program for all faculty on the UIUC campus who have a broad interest in entrepreneurial curriculum. More information can be found at www.ael.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 5A. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the ways in which politics and fashion sometimes can come together. And there, I'm sure we could find a number of case studies of that. We could talk about different places, different times. But the place that we're going to be talking about here this morning, at least to start out, is Los Angeles. And the time is 1943. We will be talking about what came to be called the Zoot Suit Riots. Now, the focus of all of this was L.A. at that time, although similar kinds of events did take place other places. But here, what happened was we had some fairly dramatic and widespread conflict on the street of the city involving servicemen, American soldiers and sailors, white servicemen, and young Mexican-American men who were known for wearing a particular style of clothing of the time, the zoot suit. People came to be called zoot suiters even if they didn't wear zoot suits. It was sort of another way of saying juvenile delinquent that also had some distinct racial overtones to it. These riots took place in Los Angeles in the 40s, and when there was fighting between both of these groups, between young Mexican-American men and American servicemen, where the Mexican-American men, particularly those wearing these clothes, were targeted, and literally the clothes were torn off of them and burned in the streets. Our guest for the show this morning is Kathy Pice. She's an historian. She's the Roy F. and Jeanette P. Nichols Professor of American History at University of Pennsylvania. And she's interested in a number of things, including the history of American women and consumer culture in historical perspective and modern American cultural history. And she has written quite a lot on the history of working women, on leisure and popular culture, on the beauty industry in the United States. She's the author of a number of books. Just one I want to mention because it was one that got a lot of attention was a book that was published in 1998 titled Hope in a Jar, The Making of America's Beauty Culture. It was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Award. She is here visiting the campus. She's going to be giving a talk, Zoot Suit Riots Revisited, Meditations on the Politics of Style, this evening at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. This is talk in the Millercom series. They're always open to the public and free. Anybody who wants to attend should feel welcome to stop by. And here on the program, as we talk, questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
We talked a little bit before we got going here, and I said my guess was that there probably would be some people listening who would not know what a zoot suit was. What was the zoot suit?
A zoot suit was an exaggerated style of men's clothing. It involved a very wide shoulder that tapered in at the waist. The jacket was long, usually fingertip length. And the pants were gathered at the waist and then billowed out at the knees, very wide at the knees, and then were tapered again at the ankles. And sometimes men would have to sew the pant leg onto them before they could actually, finish the style. They'd put on their shoes and go off.
Mm-hmm. And no one apparently knows where this got started, but it seems to be initially associated with actually young African-American men, urban men, has an association with jazz and jazz musicians. Does anybody really know where this started?
Nobody knows where the zoot suit originated, and one of the things I've been interested in is to see all the different stories about where the zoot suit came from. Some say that I think the best explanation is that it came from the swing culture, the jitterbug culture of New York in the late 1930s in Harlem at the Savoy Ballroom. But it very quickly traveled around the country. There are stories that appeared in the New York Times, for example, that the origin of the zoot suit was a busboy in Gainesville, Georgia, who happened to see Gone with the Wind and wanted to look like Rhett Butler. So you get these stories, but I think the best explanation is that it comes out of Harlem.
Yeah, that's the one that I like. Talk about irony. A young, a black man deciding he wanted to look like Rhett Butler. That probably is apocryphal. There are probably a lot of stories about it that are apocryphal because no one really knows.
Well, nobody does know. And I think what you see is that black youth, when they were interviewed by reporters from the New York Times, who had all have been white, put them on a bit. And you also hear a story about the origins of the Zoot Suit being with the Duke of Windsor, who was this incredible fashion plate. He was the abdicated king. And what I think is actually going on is that some style elements are picked up from the screen. If you do look at Rhett Butler, there are certain aspects of his dress that could be modified for wear by street youth, but I think it's a much more bottom-up phenomenon, something that's coming out of a particular youth culture.
Yeah. And so how was it that it got taken up by Mexican-American youth on the West Coast?
Well, this is a very good question, and most historians look at the Harlem and Los Angeles as completely different environments, so we don't actually know for sure how it was taken up. My own argument is that this is a style that moves very, very quickly. There's a tremendous amount of migration by young people in this time period. It's the war mobilization, and it's the end of the Depression, and young people are looking for jobs and are finding them in places like Los Angeles, Southern California. So part of it, I think, is just the physical migration of people back and forth around the country. And the mass media, too, plays a role. So Cab Calloway, for example, who's known for his outsized personality and outsized suit, he popularizes the style as well. So I think it moves in the way that a style moves very quickly today, so that you couldn't exactly pinpoint who originated it. I think that's what's going on at this time, too.
Mm-hmm. So this seems that it's one of those examples where a particular subgroup or subculture adopts something that is very distinctive, that is very provocative, in a way that marks them and also in a way that's intended to be sort of intended to be provocative, intended to be kind of out there, intended to be sort of an in-your-face kind of statement.
Well, I think it might be that, but I would also say that that young white men wear the style as well. You find it among Italians, Italian-Americans, Jewish-Americans, Japanese-Americans wear it, Philippines-Americans wear it. So within a whole range of ethnic groups, including whites, the style is adopted by some young men, I think, to give a spectacular display of their identity, to assert something about themselves on the street. But it isn't solely limited to Mexican-American and black youth, as we usually think it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the statement? I guess that's the question. It was obviously taken by some people, particularly by the sort of the establishment, as one kind of statement, as a statement that was intentionally provocative and rebellious, and challenging to the norms of society. You know, that sort of thing. That was the way that it was seen by the establishment. What to people who wore it? What did it mean? Is that what it meant to them?
I don't think that's what it meant to them, but it's very hard to know. The establishment, as you say, whether it's the police or the press, quickly identify it with juvenile delinquency, with gangs, with crime. But to the youth themselves, and this is the hardest part because those people don't write very much. I mean, if they wrote, they might not be wearing zoot suits. They're making their statement through the clothing. I think it has much more actually to do with gender issues and sexuality, with creating a space for themselves within communities which are often experiencing discrimination. For example, in leisure places, many of the suits are worn in dance halls, nightclubs, to the movies, out on the streets as a form of display. And I think that for these young men who, you know, when they are racial and ethnic minorities, are treated badly in the workplace, they're discriminated against in education, in all sorts of spheres of life, and often their parents are either non-comprehending of them or are quite strict with them, as was the case in Mexican-American families, this becomes a way of carving out a space for one's identity, of being sexually attractive, of just declaring oneself. And that, I think, is a dimension of the Zoot Suit that tends to disappear a bit because we see it so much in terms of the riot of the racial ethnic conflict that erupts in 1943.
Yeah. One angle of this I think is particularly interesting is that because at the time there was actually rationing of cloth, that this style that used all this cloth, that had this very long coat, had these very baggy pants, it was actually seen as unpatriotic to wear this. And that young men who were wearing this style, I think a lot of people saw them as slackers in the old sense of the word. That is, you know, young men who appeared to be suitable for military service but were not. So then the question was, well, what's wrong with these young men adopting this fashion? Then in the first place flaunts the rules, and in the second place, well, why are they not doing something else, working in the factory, on the battle line, you know, where other young men are that are doing their duty? What's wrong with these guys that they're not?
Yeah, I think those are all great observations. The clothing limitation orders, which are going into effect in 1943, they first do restrict the amount of cloth that could go into a suit. And when men bought suits in this time period, their suits always came with a second pair of pants. And so that was eliminated. Yeah. Vests were eliminated and the like. And the War Production Board hoped to get the Zoot Suit under control in that way. And it just got more and more popular. And so they issued a second order, for example, limiting the circumference around the knees in a pants so that you wouldn't have those baggy, billowing pants. But what's interesting is that the Zoot Suit becomes more popular even as these rationing orders or clothing limitation orders go into effect, that men are still able to get Zoot Suits or you know, buy a larger size and have it tailored into a Zoot Suit. And so there's a kind of tension there between the popularity of the suit and this sense of, well, if you're going to be patriotic, you're going to, you know, ration the amount of cloth in your clothing. The other thing to say is that many of the young men who wore Zoot Suits were not really slackers in that sense. They were not unemployed. Many of them were newly employed in the defense industries and had the money for the first time in their lives in order to buy what could be an expensive suit of clothing. And as many of the Mexican-American youth pointed out during the riot, our brothers have been drafted. I'm about to go into the army. That there isn't such a fine, sharp line between being a patriotic serviceman and being a Zoot Suiter.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kathy Pye. She's professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about the Zoot Suit, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller over in Indiana, line number 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Hello. This question may not be fashionable, but I'm not up to really what's going on in history now. When I was in school, this kind of question certainly wasn't very fashionable. But in terms of the general principles that occur within the Mexican-American community with the Zoot Suit and the black community and the jazz and all that sort of thing, is there any principles that can be brought over into contemporary styles of men and how they get moved throughout the country or, well, actually the world now, I guess? Is there any general things other than just strong anecdotal information? Thanks.
Thank you. That's a great question. I think that probably the closest analogy from the past to the present would be hip-hop. And the hip-hop styles and how controversial they are among parents, certainly. In some communities, they're frowned upon in schools. And On the other hand, young people really embracing the style, certainly within the African-American community, but it's also spread, you know, to white suburban kids as well. And I think some similar patterns are going on here. I don't expect hip-hop styles to result in a riot, but I think the tensions over looking respectable, being appropriate, what the identity is that you wish to present to the world around you, those are all issues, I think, that hip-hop raises as the Zoot Suit raised back in the 1940s.
Mm. And it just, I guess, can't help believing that that kind of thing has been a sign of youth culture probably for as long as there has been youth culture, even before we even talked about it in that way.
Yes, I think that with certainly in the 20th century, beginning in the early 20th century, clothing becomes a real marker of youth identity, and sometimes it becomes a source of real tension. Other times you just, oh, those crazy kids, look what they're wearing this year. Mm-hmm. But in the 1960s, for example, you know, women wearing men's or more androgynous clothing, with men growing their hair long, questions of gender identity in particular get raised. Like, what is it? What kind of a man are you? And how do you represent that in the way that you look? Those questions have continued to come up, and I think will continue to do so. Yeah.
Maybe we just, for people who, to whom this the whole thing is new, we should talk a little bit about the riots that took place in Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. and as I said at the beginning, there were similar kind of things that took place other places in Arizona, in where else, in Texas, and then in also some eastern cities in Detroit, in New York, in Philadelphia. But I don't think anything really quite to the extent of what happened in Los Angeles happened in other places.
Well, actually, the Detroit riot is usually seen as the worst of the group because people were killed in it. The Los Angeles riot, people were beaten up and some went to the hospital, but nobody was actually killed. And you're right to say that this is a time period. I mean, most people, when they think about the war, think about this as a period of great national unity, which it was in many, many ways. But threaded through the war years, and particularly in 1943, before it was clear that the Allies were going to win the war, and before all of the production mechanism got built up, the need for labor was intense. And so many people who in the past had never worked in high-paying jobs, African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, women, were suddenly in a workforce in a new way. And with the migration that was going on and the buildup of defense cities, a great deal of social tension developed in 43. And so you have a series of riots and periods of civil unrest from June through the summer of 43 and after, in all of those cities, in Beaumont, Texas, in Detroit, in New York, Philadelphia. And these are usually understood as race riots. If you look at Detroit, it was instantly called a race riot because it involved African Americans and whites. In Los Angeles, there was a strong effort to deny that this was a race riot, and calling it a Zoot Suit riot in a way shifted the focus away from racial discrimination or racial tensions and onto this odd style that these crazy young people were wearing.
Mm-hmm. So this definitely was a racial conflict. It was about race, but it sounds that in other ways that it was also about class and about people's uneasiness, feeling that it was at a time when things were starting to change and they weren't, and relationships between people, particularly people of different classes and different races, perhaps was starting to change, and people weren't really comfortable with that. They weren't really sure what that was all about. There was maybe concerns on one side, there were demands and expectations on the other. And it sounds like all of these things just came together in this head-on kind of crash.
Yes, it was a very volatile situation. I mean, you had a lot of servicemen who were posted in Long Beach, California, San Diego, Los Angeles, who were about to be shipped to the Pacific. You know, and so they'd have shore leave in Los Angeles, and they'd go into the entertainment places of the city. They sometimes would try to date the Mexican-American women, which the young men didn't like, and vice versa. The Mexican-American men would try to date the Anglo women. And so some of this was over, you know, a kind of turf, a kind of sexual and gender turf that was going on. And, I think your earlier point about the resentment that, you know, men who are about to go overseas and fight had against healthy, able-bodied men who were staying. That was real. And I think that the zoot suit itself kind of had a way of maybe flaunting that, or the perception was that this was flaunting a civilian status that was just not right and not fair in the context of the war.
Was it would too much of a stretch to say that this is kind of an early civil rights struggle?
I think that it's not. It doesn't work on that conscious a level, but there are Mexican American political organizations that are at this time that are trying to deal with the larger problem of discrimination against their community, and who themselves are dismayed at the Zoot Suiters, who see them as a problem. The idea among Mexican Americans, for the most part at least, was that they would assimilate and be given their rights as Americans. They were born in these are second generation people born in the U.S. and they'd be given their rights as Americans. And so the Zoot Suiters asserted a difference that they didn't really want acknowledged. It would only be much later, in the 1960s, that the Zoot Suiter, in a way, becomes a kind of model for Chicano political movements.
Yeah, that's interesting. That another dimension of this is perhaps within the Mexican American community is intergenerational conflict over issues of identity.
Absolutely, and where we don't have very many personal accounts of, you know, why a man wore a zoot suit. But where we do see this, especially where we do have a few accounts, is where parents are talking about their children, or the children are saying, "My parents just don't understand why I want to wear this suit." And so that, I think, was a real struggle, where the parents were born in Mexico and had really struggled through the 1930s, which was a very difficult time for them in the U.S., as it was for many people with the Great Depression. And the children were not following the traditions that they expected them mm-hmm. to.
Let's talk with someone else in Robinson, Illinois, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, David.
Mm-hmm.
I want to report a rather late evidence of the Zoot Suit in Oblong, Illinois, in 1945. I myself, perhaps influenced by pictures in Life magazine, tried to emulate the look of the Zoot Suit by buying a long coat and wearing pegged pants, which were themselves a reaction against the bell bottoms of the earlier generation. I bought at a hardware store a brass chain, such as was used to pull down light, to turn lights off and on, and wore it as something your author has not mentioned, the accessory of a watch or keychain dangling down past the knees and going back up into the right-hand side pocket. I was doing this as a rebellion, as many children did then, against the preceding generation, and I thought I was pretty spiffy.
I'll bet you were, too. I'm sure you were.
That's just great. How old were you?
I was 17 or 18 at the time. 1945, it would have been. I stood on the street whistling Elmo Tanner's Heartbreaks wearing my spiffy suit.
That's a wonderful story, and one of the things, and you're right about the chain, I didn't think to mention that, and also there were sort of pointed shoes sometimes, and
yes,
and a hat, and one of the things I like about your story is the way you describe it as being a kind of created fashion by yourself, I mean that you went out and bought different elements of this and put it together to create the style, because I think that's how many young men did it. They didn't go out to a store and buy a zoot suit, and in many ways they couldn't because of the clothing limitation orders, but you could still, you know, if you wanted to wear a zoot suit, you could still put it together.
That's right. And I also should mention that I was in sympathy with the Mexican Americans because I was studying Spanish at the time, although I could not be of a more WASP family than I was. That's enough. I'd better hang up.
Thank you so much.
For the story. Other questions and comments and stories are certainly welcome here on this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Kathy Pice. She's professor of American history at the University of Pennsylvania and is interested in a number of things, including the history of working women and leisure and popular culture and the beauty industry in the United States. She is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and will be giving a talk. The title is Zoot Suit Riots Revisited, Meditations on the Politics of Style, tonight at 7:30 on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center. That's on West Illinois in Urbana on the U of I campus. This is an event in the MillerCom series, has many sponsors, including the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences. All of these programs are always free and open to the public, so if you'd like to hear more from our guest, you can certainly stop by her talk. Otherwise, questions, comments are welcome here on the show, too. Well, I guess I can see how it is that this particular thing would connect with the other things that you're interested in and have written about, but maybe I'll just ask you right out. So what got you interested in thinking about and wanting to talk about the Zoot Suit?
Well, it actually started as a course. I was at the time at the University of Massachusetts, and we had a kind of course in our department which was based entirely on primary documents, on research materials created in the time period. And the idea was to make the students into historians, not just have them read history, but do it themselves. And so we had a number of these courses that were centered on scandals or murders, like the Lizzie Borden axe murder and the Black Sox scandal. Those were two of the courses that were taught. And I wanted to do something with a racial and ethnic dimension to it and something that wasn't in the East Coast. And I had always been interested in style. I'd worked a bit on it with respect to women, clearly, and with my work on the beauty industry. And I thought that the Zoot Suit Riot would be a great opportunity to have students really look at the documents of this time, to look at trial transcripts, to look at the reports that came out of the naval base from which many of the sailors came, to look at the analyses of the riot afterwards, because there are about five or six different commissions, different groups that were charged with investigating why did this thing happen, and to teach them how to use their judgment as budding historians to figure out what was really going on at the time. And so I taught this course, and I created a website, which for me was quite a trial, since I was not very experienced in instructional technology. There are great images and other kinds of popular culture sources for this, and I had a great time teaching the course, and that kind of got me started on the Zoot Suit.
What happened to the Zoot Suit? It seemed that was not something, and I suppose by nature, style, that's the way it is. Things are very popular for some period of time, and then they go away. It didn't seem really to have survived much after the war. Not really probably much after this time that we're talking about, did it?
As the exaggerated style, it didn't. But the general shape, the large shoulders, tapered waist, long jacket, drapey feel to the jacket, that really became the men's suit style of the 1950s. So it had some kind of impact. What I've been interested in looking at is the way that it gets picked up in other countries. There's a Zoot Suit Riot in Montreal in 1944, which Montrealers know about, but very few people in the U.S. do. I've been told that in Yugoslavia after the war, there were young men who wore Zoot Suits and went to the American Reading Room in Belgrade as a kind of protest against the communist leadership. And so you find the style picked up and embraced in very different contexts. And then it does certainly die out and comes back in as an icon, I would say, in the Chicano political movement of the 1960s and 70s. And then in the 1990s, I don't know if it hit here, but there was a neo-swing craze, the Cherry Poppin' Daddies. Do you know that group?
No, I'm afraid not.
And so there's a kind of dance craze that started in the 1990s, a neo-swing. And you can find Zoot Suits on the web at incredible prices, and they're really quite beautiful.
Yeah. Genuine items are things that are new versions based on the same cut?
They're new versions.
Yeah. Well, I did suspect, and I'm interested to hear that indeed that shape, because when you do think of particularly the kind of suits that men were wearing post-war, they were double-breasted. They had big shoulders. They had big lapels. They were tailored in the waist. And you look at it and say, well, that's not all that far off from – it's just a more tamed, scaled-down version of that same silhouette. And so that actually was – influenced by the popularity of this other look?
Yeah, I think so. And in general, men's fashions were heading in that direction. And men would sometimes, I mean, you can read accounts of men who say, well, I didn't wear an extreme zoot suit. I just wore a sort of modified zoot suit. And so they're even making little distinctions amongst these, you know, which to me seem like fairly small distinctions. But in fact, the overall style was one that was being popularized through the period.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with someone here. Champaign County is the caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, it's unusual for me to do a fashion report, but the president of the Swing Society comes out in all zooted up on the third Friday of the month for the band called the Pocket Big Band, where they do swingable songs. I don't know if he has a cohort that joins him in the attire on, you know, when they have their regular meetings, because I really don't attend those. But did you mention the film by Luis? Is it Luis Valdez?
Luis Valdez, yeah. Yes. Zoot Suit. I haven't mentioned it.
Ah, no. Yeah. That's. I'm wondering because it sort of, you know, has a trial in it, if I recollect correctly, and it sort of tries to capture the scene in the L.A. I actually would like to hear more about how these the Midwestern Zoot riots started. And I assume they were more strictly African American. I'm wondering whether there was any manipulation from, you know, the authority side of things in this. I don't know if that's treated in Valdez, but, you know, that you've conjured up the war scene at home fairly well, but I'm wondering if you might be able to say some more about that and maybe something on the, how you feel the film was good and perhaps if it had any things that you regard as glaring. I guess I'll just dance on off here. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Well, the Valdez work, Zoot Suit, which started as a play in Los Angeles and then became a movie, is a really interesting film because it's one of the examples of the return to the Zoot Suiter as an icon for contemporary Chicano political movements. And the film is based largely on the trial transcripts of what was known as the Sleepy Lagoon murder, which happened before the Zoot Suit riot. It happened in 1942. It was a murder that took place in a home where a party was going on. It was a Mexican-American party. A young man, Jose Diaz, was killed. And in response, the Los Angeles police just rounded up literally hundreds of Mexican-American men, put them behind bars, and then charged a large group of them with the murder. And so that trial went on through 1942. It was a very controversial trial. There was a defense group that was founded by people in Hollywood and people more on the left. It was a trial where the young men were clearly not being it had procedural problems, let me say. The young men were forced to wear the zoot suits that they had been arrested in. They were not allowed to cut their hair. They were convicted, and then the conviction was overturned. And so Valdez creates a story around this very powerful murder. And he has a number of kind of mythic elements, a kind of mythic zoot suiter, mythic Mexican figure who comes in and is a voice that tries to encourage some of the Mexican-American men to embrace their zooter identities. So it's, I think it's a really interesting movie that's based partly on historical fact and literally on the historical record, and then imagines a kind of world of the Zooter as well. As far as the authorities are concerned, I think that the way that zoot suiting or zoot suiters become labeled criminal, gangs, violent, that that is coming from the authorities, particularly the police in Los Angeles and from the press in Los Angeles. The press wages war against zoot suiters starting in 42, and it's partly it's a circulation war between the Hearst newspaper and another newspaper, but it really does inflame sentiments there in a way that isn't the case in other cities. In other cities, it really is much more of a black-white kind of tension that you're seeing.
Well, you certainly do see, as you say, in the press accounts of the time, you do see editorializing on the subject of violence, on white, on Latino violence as being, and a lot of negative stuff written about the zoot suiters in sort of in this way of saying, well, they get what's coming to them. Is there some suggestion that the authorities, if not encouraging violence, somehow aided and abetted, or perhaps turned away from violence?
During the riot, the authorities were not quick to try to stop what was going on. Although I think almost all accounts would say this is Anglo or white servicemen and civilians attacking Mexican-American youth. The majority of people who were arrested were Mexican-American, the vast majority. No sailors, for example, were arrested. The police certainly hung back, and eventually the Navy decided they had to step in, and they ended shore leave for the sailors, and that it's what made the riot really stop. And the city government was upset about this because they depended upon the tourist dollars of the sailors, but they were not at all concerned to stop it, and it went on for eight days.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Kathy Pice. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about zoot suits and the zoot suit riots of the 40s, a subject that she's here on the campus to talk about. Zoot Suit Revisited: Meditations on the Politics of Style. That's the title she's put on the talk. That's tonight on the campus. Of course, right here, if you have questions, comments, you can be involved in the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess when I think about fashion, broadly speaking, that sometimes you look at people's clothes and they can fall broadly into two categories. One is a category that clearly says, look at me, and the other is the category that says, don't look at me. You know, either I want to be seen or I don't want to be seen. And in men's fashion, certainly there are plenty of times through history where people, particularly privileged people, have adopted clothing that says, look, that's waving the flag that says, look at me. But generally speaking, men's fashion mostly seems to be about don't look at me. They're not interested in being seen. And the interesting things are those times when men have taken on clothing that's really intended to attract attention, to get looked at.
Yeah, there's the long history of men's clothing. There's a point in it's really the early modern period, the 18th century, where men stop being peacocks and they begin to embrace a style that you might call inconspicuous consumption. You might judge a man by the cut of his cloth or by the quality of the cloth, but it's not through display. And historians have a number of explanations for that. In part, the rejection of aristocratic of aristocracy, the embrace of a more democratic politics, the needs of business, where you need to show that you are someone who is trustworthy. I mean, people don't know each other as well face to face, and so you need to convey through your clothing that you're serious, that you're respectable, that you're trustworthy. And so the kind of classic men's suit really comes in around the early 1800s, and it means that is the background against which there are moments when men dress in spectacular ways, and they sort of punctuate history. They're dandies, for example, who want to show their sort of aesthetic superiority and come in the 19th century. They're the zoot suiters in the 1960s, the embrace of casual denim and the like, T-shirts. These are all moments that are against a backdrop of sameness, that men kind of generally have understood their respectability and their seriousness and their identity in terms of a very neutral appearance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just makes you wonder what is happening at the times of the breakout, where you see, for example, a time if you look at the ways that people were dressing, say in the late men were dressing in the late 1950s, was not particularly flamboyant, and yet there was some. Then comes this moment when some men, at least, embrace a wild sort of we suddenly get these profiles where we get these big lapels and when people wearing these big ties and all kinds of bright colors and pants that flare out at the bottom and men start wearing high heels again and it just really just going wild, at least some men do. And why it is that happens at certain times. And then it goes away. I think it's interesting how those things come and go and why they come and go.
Yeah, I feel like I should paraphrase Freud. Don't ask me what men want. ask the poets. But I think, I think that it's very much involved with masculinity and with moments when there are tensions over what the definition of masculinity should be. And sometimes those are generational tensions. Sometimes they're class tensions. But, the man in the gray flannel suit in the 1950s,
sure.
Seen as the figure of conformity, of leading a boring life, of being obliged to raise your children and have a happy home taken care of by your wife, that model becomes one that seems less and less relevant to another generation. And I think that gets expressed in terms of in terms of clothing as well as in many other behaviors.
Well, let's talk with some other people here. We'll go to an Urbana listener on line one. Hello.
Good morning. I was heading to the same place that you guys just touched on. In an earlier life, I made a run at interior design and was really influenced by a book that talked a lot about personal space and people's need for, elbow room and how many chairs can you put in a lobby before people, start hating one another and that kind of thing. And it seems to me as if that's the same thing that you're talking about. I'd like to see somebody who's an anthropologist take a look at, the biology of style, because I think that's part of the driver that you're talking about. And it really is an interesting loop to me to, you mentioned hip-hop a half an hour or so ago, because, as society gets more intense about its expectations of what our behaviors are or whatever, then people respond. And, you put something on your body that makes you unique and says, I have my space, I own this, even if it's, my shoulders plus or minus 6 or 7 inches. You wonder why we have hip-hop styles the way we do, for example, where young men are almost immobilized. And I've brainstormed this with friends. And, one of the conclusions I come to is that basically they're saying, I don't need to run. I can wear pants that are down, almost, past my rear end, because I don't need to be afraid of, the police or the authorities or whatever else is happening in that culture. And so just a thought there. Interesting conversation. Thank you very much, David.
Well, thanks for the call.
Well, that's a very interesting comment, because clothing, it has all sorts of symbolic meanings, but at its most fundamental, it's a covering for the body, and it's a way of revealing and exposing the body, of containing the body. And one of the things about hip-hop clothing, as with the zoot suit, is that it makes young men walk and be in space in a different way than if they were wearing more conventional clothes. And I think that that's an important part of it, the physical feeling of moving through space, in the case of a zoot suit, with all this cloth around you, and especially if you're dancing, jitterbug, there's the thrill of that, and they often talk about this, that it was just an incredible thrill to be in motion with your clothing surrounding you. And I think with hip-hop, you know, that the it forces young men to walk in a particular way that does occupy space in a different way than if they were wearing conventional clothes. So I think that's a great comment.
All right. So to a nearby community, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to mention that the stereotypical aspects of the zoot suit are still with us, if you consider movies and cartoons and stuff like The Mask and,
yes,
and cartoons where it's always a wolfish individual in a wolf in a zoot suit that is being the character of the little show or whatever it is. And I think it's kind of interesting. The same perceptions you talked about in 1943 have kind of wandered right on down to us today.
Yes, I think that's true, and I didn't think to mention The Mask when I was going over my litany of recent zoot suit styles, but there's a long tradition in cartooning, and it starts in the 1940s, of using the zoot suit, a zoot suited figure. It's often the wolf, someone who is, you know, sort of sexually aggressive, is creating havoc. You see this in, there's a Disney film, for example, in 1943 that has a zoot suitor trying to get Donald Duck to spend his hard-earned money in a bar instead of paying his taxes. And that figure, I think, just continues to run through cartooning. And I think of the Jim Carrey figure as basically a cartoon figure who also, you know, becomes something else when he puts on the mask and turns into this wild zoot suitor.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks. That, I think, was really very much an homage to Tex Avery, who was the guy, who was the animator who did, you know, if anybody knows about zoot suits, they have seen, if they're of the right age, they have seen some of that animation work, where indeed it was the wolf, quote unquote, the wolf always was a zoot suitor.
Yes, swing shift Cinderella and Little Red Hot Riding Hood,
yes,
are the a couple of the films in which that wolf in zoot suit clothing appears.
Yeah, read. I guess I'm interested in hanging here with the last minute or two about what the clothes that we seem to be wearing now say about us, if they wear anything. I'm interested in the idea that we seem to be very much interested in comfort. The profile nowadays is fairly loose. It's not a time when people are wearing really tight clothing. People wear clothes that look like they've been washed about 1,000 times. We like to go out and buy brand new clothing that's already been faded for us.
Yes, it's always hard for me to talk about the present, being a historian. I never really know how to contextualize it, but it seems to me that comfort and casualness and a certain kind of a sense of not being proper is expressed in our clothing. And I think that has in some ways to do with class, actually, and with the way that we don't want to address class differences. We don't want to mark ourselves as being of different classes. And if we can all dress the same, then we, you know, if we consume the same, then we are the same. And to me, that effaces the real class differences that do exist in our society. But again, I don't really want to be quoted on this.
Yeah.
I'm a historian.
I understand that. Well, that's interesting. I think just in kind of in the run-up to this conversation, I think my wife and I were having this conversation the other day about blue jeans being the great leveler, in a sense. That would connect with that idea that, again, we sort of like, even though maybe in our heart of hearts we know we're not all the same, we like to pretend that we're all the same. And one way you can do that, I suppose, is everybody kind of dressing all the same. Even, and it's something that cuts across the age ranges as well. I think about this sometimes. I think about the fact that I'm sure never in my life did I ever see my grandfather wearing blue jeans. Never. I'm sure never. He never wear them. I don't know if he ever owned a pair, but I never saw him wearing one. But now, you know, my father, he's 77 years old. He is a grandfather. He wears blue jeans. Everybody wears blue jeans.
Yes, and men don't wear ties as much as they used to. I think there's a kind of standard now of casual appropriateness. And you see this with the recent NBA order to the basketball stars to wear their, you know, casual appropriate is the general standard of the U.S.
Well, for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest, Kathy Pice, will be talking about the Zoot Suit, getting at some of the more historical kind of themes that we've talked about here in the conversation, talking on the topic Zoot Suit Riots Revisited, Meditations on the Politics of Style. This is an event in the Millercom series. Anybody is welcome to attend, free and open to the public. That's tonight, 7:30, on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus on West Illinois. She is the Roy F. and Jeanette P. Nichols Professor of American History at University of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Focus 580, this program, in fact, all of our programming is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. We'd like to thank them for their support of WILL, and we'd like to thank everybody who made a contribution here to WILL last week during our fall fundraising effort. In fact, 1,225 friends helped us raise over $125,000 during last week's pledge drive, and we'd also like to welcome the 204 new friends who came on board during the drive. Your support helps us sustain the programs and services that you have come to expect and enjoy. And we want to say to you, thank you very much. A bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking with John Katz. Last time he was a guest on the Afternoon Magazine, they talked about how the work of dogs has become more and more about giving emotional support to humans. His book, The New Work of Dogs, has just been published, and his latest is also about the canine-human connection. It's a guide to training and living with dogs called Cats on Dogs, and he'll be talking with Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the program today. The show itself, as usual, gets underway with the customary mix of news and sports and weather and features and other things. Gets underway at noon, and then the interview comes up in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. In the next hour of this program, we'll be talking with one of Colombia's most distinguished public intellectuals. He's an historian and also a librarian. His name is Jorge Orlando Melo. He directs a very large library in Bogota that draws millions of people a year. He says, in fact, he could well be the most visited public library in the entire world. More from him in the next part of the show. We'll take a break, as we usually do this time, for an update on the markets and for news, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Deferred pricing contracts available this fall. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at LincolnLandAgriEnergy.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the futures market at the Chicago Board of Trade. December corn.